Desafinado, Discord. Why Discord? Because we talk in a different way about books and book publishing, or try to anyway. You are listening to WPKN 89.5 FM, the book and book publishing program of WPKN. I am Hans Koning, novelist. We must begin today with a correction. In our most recent program, we had Benjamin Dumotte, editor of a literary magazine, First of the Month. I told you then that they had a circulation of 70,000, but that was wishful thinking. It is 7,000. Of course, each reader of that fine magazine counts for 10. Today, our guest is Tom Engelhardt, editor of Metropolitan Books and writer of a recent novel with the ominous title The Last Days of Publishing. I asked him if that was really how he feels about what's going on in the book world.
By the time I started writing The Last Days of Publishing, I had been an editor in mainstream publishing, or at least at the edges of mainstream publishing, for maybe close to 30 years. And I think I had hit a point where I was losing faith in the not so much in writing, but in the book. Heading out into the world. You know, the book is such a modest object, really. It's a modest object that promises to break you into immodest spaces. And it suddenly found itself at the end of my 30 years in publishing, with publishing companies having been, you know, gobbled up one after another. Publishing itself as a business found itself more or less in the sub-basement of the entertainment conglomerate. And the book itself was being increasingly thrown out into the world, into a world in which, as I like to say culturally, the wallpaper's screaming. And it's harder for books to scream than certain other cultural objects of our moment. And I think I was feeling a kind of a loss of faith, not in the book per se, but in what the book could do in the world. And it's a very strange thing to decide. I didn't really decide. How do you decide to write anything? I began to write a novel about publishing at the moment when I had kind of lost a certain faith in publishing. I feel a little differently now, but in any case, that's kind of how I headed into it. And but I have to say also that the title, I stole it, as you say, from The Last Days of Pompeii, which was a 19th century a potboiler filled with sex, moralism, and I don't know what else of a kind that doesn't exist anymore. I the thing about Pompeii, I actually begin with scenes in Pompeii. And the thing about Pompeii is, of course, Pompeii went, but many people in Pompeii didn't die. And I think my title is meant, and I think it reflects the reality of publishing, it's meant somewhat ironically in the sense that what's the last days of anything for someone until the end of our planet is not the last days for someone else. And in this particular case, I think it's been the last days for a certain kind of publishing, and one that I was very much involved in, because I began at Pantheon Books, which was kind of one of the last of the little cottage industry houses, although already absorbed in a much larger in Random House, which had been absorbed already by the time I arrived in 1976 by RCA. So the eating had begun, but I nonetheless had the feeling in 1976 of like a little cottage industry, and that part of publishing has largely disappeared, I think. So for people like me, although not quite for me, it's publishing in recent years has had a bit of a last days feeling. I still actually work in publishing, but there's that element. So, but I meant it to be, as I say, to be somewhat ironic. Yes.
Yes, a realist. You had this dramatic exodus connected with Andrew Shifrin.
That's right.
How many years had you done before that?
I was at Pantheon for 16 years, I think. Oh, 15 wow. or 16 years. It was a long time. And although I left under special circumstances, it was a group of editors who quit because our boss was thrown out, was kind of forced into retirement. But in fact, Pantheon, which was a little kind of, you might say, along with maybe Basic Books, Basic was a little different. It was kind of the left wing of mainstream publishing, and the 80s and early 90s was not a good time for such publishing. So that Pantheon event, which was in 1990, was the beginning of a wave that crested and actually swept almost everything away, every house like Pantheon, even the ones outside of the conglomerates, were basically swept up, gobbled up by the conglomerates. I mean, I think there's one left now, W.W. Norton, that has not been eaten alive, and everything else has gone into a conglomerate. Sometimes they've gone in, they've been spit out again, because often these houses didn't work very well. You know, when I came into publishing, RCA already owned Random House, which owned Pantheon, and RCA had bought Random House with a very strange set of publishing dreams, and it was typical of a lot of big corporations that have bought smaller things. It was already beginning to imagine a computer future, and it dreamt that somehow Random House would be able to put content in its computers, which would be teaching in classrooms. And of course, once they got Random House, publishing just doesn't make as much money as a lot of these other entertainment wings of entertainment, and they didn't know what to do with it. I remember we used to get a magazine called, I don't know, the RCA Family Magazine, and it would always say they had far-flung interests, and their tree business would be, you know, their timber business would be doing this, and their electronics would be, and they'd have fabulous figures for profits, and then it would always say as a last tagline, and Random House did well, or did okay, and there was never a figure, because publishing didn't do that well, and finally, they didn't know what to do with publishing, and they spit it out. They spit Random House out. And this happened very typically. Places got spit out, they got bought up again. But sooner or later, all the smaller places ended up subsumed in these bigger places. And this is basically what I wrote about in my novel. I wrote about it. It's the story of an editor kind of running off the rails, who's lived through this process, and he's in a small house that's been constantly eaten up. He has the good fortune to have one best-selling pop psychologist author who kind of keeps him afloat. In any case, it was an attempt to catch this process, this feasting process, at which I was present. I was kind of like a lot of other people in publishing. I was serving while they were eating, and the thing about publishing is not a business that historically has been much memorialized.
I want to be a bit more general. At this point, the thing being, I realize older than you, and I've been around publishing from another point of view as a writer,
right,
very long.
Right.
And what happened was, in the early days, I always told people and believed this, once you have a book published, then you're sort of in, then you don't have to worry anymore about selling and hassling, because once you are accepted as a writer, then you are a writer. It's just a matter of getting your first book out. And this, of course, is totally no longer true.
No, it's no longer true.
But now, having you here, I don't quite understand why not, because you would think that is a very efficient way and a very economic way to find writers who are really writers and not just amateurs or hobbyists, and that way the publishing house would be much easier than if they have to start each time to find somebody who is going to make an enormous, who will be a bestseller, quote-unquote. I don't understand how the economics can work for this swallowing each other up.
Yes, well, I mean, I'm not sure I understand the economics of it either. I mean, I think largely they haven't worked totally well. I think this is the problem. I think when you look at the book, you know, the problem with the book is, unlike most of the rest of the consumer package, it's such a labor-intensive activity. I mean, reading, you're really, every time you read, you're breaking, I mean, unless you're reading, you know, the 19th novel of, you know, in some series, you have to break a code. It's a very difficult thing to do.
Well, it's a nice way of putting it.
I mean, if you look at a sitcom, I watch TV like everybody else. You know, once you get into the rhythm of a sitcom, there's not a lot of code breaking to do. Once you know one sitcom, you kind of can lie down and watch. It's not that hard. You like it or you don't like it, but it doesn't take a lot of effort. A book takes so much effort. And the problem is that the audience for books, even at the highest level, in order for book companies to really work in these giant corporations, The book business has to be a mass entertainment business. And the problem with the book is it really is not a mass entertainment business. Even if you're at the top of the pecking order in terms of bestsellers, if you're, say, Stephen King, you're still selling numbers, I mean, in the millions, admittedly, but so much under what, say, a successful film would do. You'd be off the radar screen of a successful film in terms of numbers, just a book sold, even if you're at the top of bestsellerdom. And of course, from that very top, you drop down very fast.
But this is an argument for small family houses, I would almost say.
Well, there are, you know, this is why one can only be so gloomy, because there are, in fact, there are all sorts of wonderful little houses that the little houses haven't gone away. I mean, in the world that I know, I mean, Seven Stories or New Press or Nation Books, there are a lot. I'm in a more political world now. I have a website called TomDispatch.com, and I'm in this much more political world. But the book selling in that world, there is a world of little presses. They're still around. They're doing fine. They're just a teeny percentage of, you know, books sold. That's all. They're very small scale, and it's not an inappropriate way to sell books. I agree. I think that, you know, there's a real place for the small scale, but in mainstream publishing, the pressures are so fierce, and this I've experienced. You know, to give you to put it in a personal context, I remember a moment in the early years of Pantheon, where, I don't know, I was publishing some book, and I got a wonderful quote from, I think it was Lewis Thomas, and we had a crisis in the house about whether we should put the quote on the front of the book. You know, it seemed very tacky at the time. There was an enormous argument we finally did. Today, the pressures being so high, I would paste any quote I got anywhere on a book. I mean, it's not even a thought anymore. And part of the reason is that the book, you now have these enormous bookstores, Barnes & Noble, Borders, and so on and so forth. The book goes out into the sea of books, and in the same bookstore there are CDs and movies and, you know, paraphernalia. And something needs to point at that book, because otherwise it disappears into the sea of books, of course. And I mean, when I started in publishing again, if a book won an award, you know, you won the National Book Critics Circle Award, well, I mean, that meant small numbers of added sales, but very small. Now, if you win an award like that, you know, it's like an arrow pointing at the book, and it says, and people are looking for some kind of direction, yes? Yeah. So, the book has to shout louder now than it ever did. And this puts pressure. This makes it very hard in terms of the people you're talking about, you know, a person who starts. I mean, typically when we started people, you know, when I started working with authors and when I first came into publishing, I all I wanted to work with was unknown authors. I was unknown, and I wanted to rescue people like me from kind of the peripheries of the world with interesting thoughts who I could bring closer to the mainstream. This was my goal. But when you were, and our idea at the time was, you know, you started with a book, it was modest, it had a modest success, and then you built an author's career, and they stayed with you, you know. This obviously now, you know, a book comes in, it more or less has to work, it has to shout somehow. If it doesn't work, there's a lot of pressure against going back that second time, or it only works very modestly. It's a much harder environment, just as the book out in the world has a harder environment. I mean, there's some positive things, too, I could talk about, but in terms of the difficulties of any author or any book, it's a rugged world out there, and people have less time.
You're listening to Literary Discord, and our guest is Tom Engelhardt, editor and writer. Tom, I want to ask you a crucial question, as far as I understand the situation, which is connected with the distribution, which is leads to away from what you just said about prices. But you say there are still small, serious houses like Seven Stories and Nation Books and stuff like that. How do they distribute their wares?
They usually have some kind of larger distributor. I mean, they don't do it themselves anymore. They have some. The New Press, I think, goes through Norton, which is the last independent house. Seven Stories and Nation Books, I think they simply go through larger distributors. there are larger distributors out there, a larger company, or they're linked to something, some larger entity out there that's distributing books, often for lots of smaller places.
And
so,
when I started out, there were guys in who drove around in the country with a stack of books and went to call them bookstores. Is that no longer done?
Oh, never.
I see. Now,
you know, this was before my time at Pantheon, but Pantheon had a great bestseller, Dr. Zhivago, and Pasternak's famous novel. And when demand became high, in New York, they simply jumped into taxi cabs with piles of books and took them to the bookstores right out of Pantheon. But, of course, that no longer exists. The other thing you can say, if you want to talk positively, is that at that time, bookstores tended to be, a lot of them were in department stores. There were many less of them. My wife comes from El Paso, Texas. In El Paso, Texas, you would have had a lot of trouble buying books. Now you can go there, and you can go into a Barnes & Noble and see an enormous range of books. And this is a major, if you're talking positively, this is a major change in a lot of the country. I mean, there's much more access to books, but of course there's access to everything else as well.
Yes. And how does the element of choice work?
Meaning what? I'm
sorry. Meaning that potential reader walks into this El Paso bookstore and says, "Do you have a nice novel for me?" What will he ask for?
Well, this is why I say any arrow pointing at a book. This is why, in essence, and increasingly, it's always been true that authors, that some authors went out and performed their books. Dickens was a great performer. If you look at he carefully accented. He marked the emphases in his book, and he did so that he could just hit when he did readings. He could do it just right. He loved it. He came to the United States and he had huge crowds. He was an immense success. So authors have always done it, but authors didn't always have to do it. It wasn't always assumed they would do it. Now, in essence, I think, as an author, You in essence have to perform your work in translation to get people to come to it. And there's nothing saying that that someone who writes a beautiful book should necessarily be very good on the radio or on television or in a reading or anything else. A lot of this stuff in my book. This is the last days of publishing. I play out in a fictional form, and it was great fun for me because I got to revisit. My experiences in public. I mean, it's not my literal experiences, but it's the world I knew, and one of my jokes in the book is that each chapter takes place around a meal. There's the famed publishing lunch.
Yes.
And so two editors kind of refight the Vietnam War in a Chinese restaurant. And,
yes.
There are a whole series. Almost everything in the book takes place in some relationship to food.
I remember that. That's very effective.
Although people joke about publishing lunches and it is funny in a way, and they are ridiculous in some sense. There was some small element of I understood once I was in publishing why they existed, which was that if you meet an author, and you're sitting in an office, you're kind of bound in some way, and often for the mind to work, you need to have time freed up, and going out to this lunch, or dinner or whatever it was, it kind of took the boundaries off time. So you could sit there and in a way wait until the author had gotten to the point where he or she could actually talk about what they wanted to talk about. It wasn't quite business anymore. And that was actually a very nice feeling. So I wasn't much of a, I'm not much of a luncher to begin with, but I could see the point of getting out of the office. The ritual was interesting. And so I had a great fun writing about that ritual, actually.
I see that you are managing a consulting editor of Metropolitan Books.
Yes,
what does that entail?
Well, Metropolitan is part of, it's an imprint of Holtz, which is part of one of the two big German conglomerates, von Holtzbrink, that now dominate a lot of publishing. What I actually do now is I'm the co-creator, and I run with another editor a series called the American Empire Project, which is a very political series of books. We do Chalmers Johnson's The Sorrows of Empire. We do Noam Chomsky's most recent book and various other books. And, you know, I like, as I've done for a million years, I go out, I find the books, I edit them. I mean, the truth is, most people, most editors in publishing today don't really edit. And many don't even know really what editing is. But I do. I've been an editor all my life. It's a very strange thing to stumble into. And it was one of the things I had most fun writing about. The editor I create is very different as an editor from me, but we shared certain thoughts. And it was great fun, fictionally, to share certain thoughts with somebody in my profession. But I do sit down. I mean, I word by word, line by line, I'm with the author beginning to end. And it's a great feeling. And actually, I think the greatest feeling as an editor is that, you know, it's funny, there's a word that's very negative in our language, which is used. People say either it's a used car, meaning secondhand, not very good, or I've been used, I've been exploited. But the beautiful thing about being an editor is actually being used. It's not like being a critic at all. You're helping somebody in process, and if they do it right, if the person you're editing is a good writer, you go at their manuscript, you try and unknot them in all sorts of ways, and then they go at it again, and they basically obliterate you. And by the time you're done, if all goes well, you've been subsumed into the manuscript. If I look back in manuscripts I've edited, I shouldn't be able to see myself there at all. I should have been, in a sense, obliterated, except maybe on an acknowledgments page. And it's a kind of a wonderful thing to be used in that way.
So
anyway,
the consulting is really consulting the authors.
Consulting was kind of a joke. Metropolitan was started by a friend, and she asked me to come along on the ride. This was back in the mid-1990s, and I said, well, I never want to go. I had been in an office. I had been at Pantheon for 16 years, and then I had been out for a few years. I said, I never want to go back in an office again, but let's call me consulting editor. We made it up over a meal. It doesn't have a great deal of meaning. It just meant to me, I don't have to be in the office, and I'm very seldom in the office.
I see. You should make a French film. They love stories tied into with meals.
I'm ready for they just have to come and offer. I'm ready to sell the book for nothing.
But does the Metropolitan do fiction and nonfiction?
Oh yes, they do. They do. I don't, but they do.
Oh.
I mean, I don't do fiction, but Metropolitan does do fiction. Yes. Yes.
And you find when you say you find a book for them.
Yes, I go out. Well, I've done this for.
How does one find a book?
Ah, gosh.
I mean, a book that hasn't been published yet.
Right. Right. Well, you know, I mean, one thing I do is I read incredibly widely. I do this anyway for my website, so I'm always reading. You know, if I see an interesting article, I see somebody who has interesting thoughts, you know, I'll write them, I'll call them, I've been in this world for so long that people also, you know, people will call me and say, you know, somebody, here's a guy who's written something fascinating, and you really should take a look at it. So, you know, I now have a whole world of people who have worked with me, writers I've published, and they often, you know, they often make suggestions. I look around and I'll contact somebody. That's basically what I do. I look for interesting people, and then I try and convince them that they should write a book or that they should give the book they're writing to me. Those are the two possibilities. Most people in publishing now, I'm very rare in this way, most people in publishing get their books through literary agents.
Wow.
That is, the agents send them proposals. This almost never happens.
How does this website of yours work?
It's kind of an alternate news website. I started off, it was post 9/11. I couldn't stand the coverage we were getting in this country of the world. And I started basically an e-list, suggesting articles that I thought were interesting, rather like being being an editor looking for books. I began looking for interesting articles about the world, and then I began, doing commentary. And then I began asking authors like Chalmers Johnson or Mike Clare or whoever, who I had worked with, if they would write pieces for me, and I started publishing. It's like a little magazine online. I do my own commentary. I, for instance, just wrote a long piece about the neocons' idea that we're actually in World War IV. This is the global war on terror, and I tried to to analyze that. And I do my own stuff, I do other people's stuff, and I post regularly 3 or 4 times a week, and you can go sign up. It's www.tomdispatch.com.
Don't stop it.
Yeah.
We can't make propaganda on this program.
Oh, okay.
But it came across, the message came
across. Oh, that's fine. Across. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Anyway, a final question before our time is up.
Yeah, yeah.
A few words of advice for somebody who wants to write a book.
Ah, well.
And wants to get it published, let's say. It's already written, but nobody wants to see it.
I'm
in a drawer.
The truth of the world is you probably have to go. There aren't many of me left. You probably have to go and find a literary agent.
Right.
That's the honest truth of it. I don't think there's much of another way at this point. And in truth, as I wrote somewhere in my novel, to even though I do it with my own books, to go into the literary world without an agent at this point is like saying the knight walked onto the field of battle without armor. I think that's the honest truth of it.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Okay.
And the best of luck with your projects
and all
the new writers who are listening to you. I wish them the best of luck too. Thank you, Tom.
Thanks, Hans.
You have listened to Literary Discord, the book program of WPKN 89.5 FM. Our guest was Tom Engelhardt. I am Hans Koning, novelist, and our producer is Scott Harris, activist. Literary Discord is broadcast on 89.5 on the fourth Thursday of the month at 12 noon, and the program is repeated on the second Tuesday of the following month at 9:30 in the evening. Thank you for listening.